Hey friends, this is Scott. I want you to know how much I appreciate you as listeners, and I hope you appreciate my sponsors because they make this show possible. Raygun provides full-stack error, crash, and performance monitoring for tech teams. Whether you're a software engineer looking to diagnose and resolve issues with greater speed and accuracy, or a product manager drowning in bug reports, or maybe you're just concerned you're losing customers to poor quality online experiences, Raygun can provide you with the answers. Get full-stack error and performance monitoring in one place. The next time you're struggling to replicate errors and performance issues in your code base, think Raygun. Head over to raygun.com, that's R-A-Y-G-U-N.com, and get up and running within minutes and dramatically improve your online experiences of your users. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today I'm talking with Jenny Shen, and she's calling from, are you in Holland right now?
Yes, I am in Holland.
And you live there right now?
I live in Amsterdam.
Fantastic. How long have you been in Europe?
I have lived in Amsterdam for about 3 years now.
Uh-huh. And when I look on your website, it says that you are an independent UX and product designer, but you're Canadian and you've worked in many different countries. You've traveled all over the globe. You're almost like a digital nomad.
Exactly. That's also how I tell other people I'm a digital nomad.
Did you decide that one day? You said, I'm going to have a business, I'm going to be an independent, and I will use my business to travel the world?
Actually, it's more like it was a dream and it was a goal because I've met, while I was an intern, I met other people who do that. And I just thought it was such a cool career and I want to do that in the future. So I kind of actively work towards getting to that goal. And here I am.
That's fantastic. I'm looking at your about page and it's just full of international speaking and you're all over Europe and you're doing workshops. You seem like you're not just a UX and product person, but you are a global one. You focus on design for everybody. And I think that a lot of us really just design for our local audience.
Yeah, I think I am very lucky to have the opportunity to be able to move several countries and also have several clients trust me to design for just more than their local country. So I really love what I do.
Mm-hmm. I was looking at a talk that you gave about building bridges, not walls, and designing for users across cultures. It says that you've traveled to nearly 50 countries, lived in six, and work with users from 27. That's basically everyone. That's almost everyone.
Yeah. So it's just kind of like what I've been doing for the past few years. And I'm lucky to be in this niche. And I find it so interesting to design for international users, localization, like this kind of cross-cultural experiences, user experiences really fascinates me.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've done basic internationalization. That's when you see like I, the number 18, and N, which is, you know, like remembering that German words are longer, so making room for them. And, you know, Chinese and Japanese, kanji is smaller. Things will shape and lay out differently. But when you're talking about UX design across different cultures, it's not just changing strings, right?
No, it's not. It's more like be aware of the not just the character length, the more about how does culture actually affect the user experiences. And in my talk, I give examples about how the interface for the Netherlands and the neighbor Germany can actually have a difference. And then also interface in Japan or China, like how does that differ from the interface of the West? So those kind of examples where people don't really research or think about. And I just talk about that in my talk.
Yeah. I understand that you reference Jakob Nielsen's book, International User Interfaces, and there's a great quote that says, it's not simply enough to offer a product translated to 10 or 20 languages. Users want a product that acknowledges their cultural characteristics and business practices. I think I've just been changing strings in a text file all this time.
I guess to be fair, people don't really know. There's not really like official courses that teach people how culture affect user experiences. I also didn't learn that when I studied interaction design. It was more like when I travel and when I design for the local audience, and I realize, hey, there's actually a big difference. So I wanted to reference that book, which is a by like authors that most people in UX know about, to say mm-hmm. that, hey, this is something that's very important. That's kind of bring more awareness into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in a number of your blog posts and posts that you've pointed to, you reference actual studies. Like, these aren't necessarily opinions as they are like practical scientific studies or formal studies. For example, one professor said that there's six aspects for cultural differences: power, distance.
Power, distance, masculinity, femininity, individualism, and...
There was uncertainty, avoidance. Yeah. Long-term orientation and indulgence. And yes. you call out one really interesting, comparing Taiwan with the U.S.
Yeah, yeah. So in that chart, you can actually see how in host data, power dimension, the cultural dimensions, how the U.S. is different from Taiwan, which is actually the country that I'm born in.
Mm. And it says here that in the U.S., individualism is very important, while in Taiwan, long-term orientation is important. What is long-term orientation?
So long-term orientation is how the user kind of perceive or changes the action in order to do stuff in order to do stuff that's more for long-term purposes. And you usually link that to saving or instead of making short-term decisions, people make long-term decisions. So that how that can affect the user interface might be that price sensitivity or any sort of decisions related to short-term and long-term. And Taiwanese users are more likely to choose it for the long-term benefits instead of short-term. Like instead of instant gratification, users where countries have high long-term orientation scores tend to choose it for the long-term benefits.
Interesting. So like I literally, you know, a couple hours ago was looking at my banking on like mint.com, which is like an Intuit mm-hmm. product. And it's very much like my budget and my financial future and my, like it is very individual focused, but it's also trying to get me through budgeting for the next month. There's not a lot of how will my family be in 10 years type of planning. It seems to line up exactly with what you were saying. It's designed for a United States person.
Yeah. So I don't design that much in fintech, but I assume this is kind of my assumption that perhaps mm-hmm. in Asia, the banking will kind of give a user the more yearly overview. Maybe there will be more services towards saving for their children, saving for their grandchildren, and more like a long-term investment plan. This is just a guess, but I'm trying to make this make sense for the listeners who are trying to understand what's the difference of long-term and short-term orientation.
Right, right. I think that the point is that it's an educated guess to say that these are in fact how different cultures, you know, juxtapose, how they're different. It's clear that Taiwan is different from the U.S. and how people, you know, go about and move about their lives. And then if you compare Taiwan with another country or the U.S. with another country, you would see different axes. So it sounds like sometimes you would have to create an almost entirely different UX depending on what your market is.
Exactly. Yeah.
You also talk about a map from Aaron Meyer that talks about the axes between emotionally expressive versus unexpressive and confrontational versus avoiding confrontation.
Yep. So Aaron Meyer's culture map is a great book, and it talks more about how culture affects international teams, more in the sense of teamwork and management instead mm-hmm. of how it affects the interface.
Oh, interesting. So you are applying these workings not just to the actual UX and the user interface, but also to the teams that you work with as you travel around the world.
Exactly. So recently I work with international teams, and there are distributed teams where there's members from the US, from Hong Kong, from Poland, from UK. And I have to pay attention to the subtlety where members of the UK are more a little bit more indirect. So I have to be more careful when giving feedback to the designers in UK and versus to my main clients in the US, and they actually prefer if I just talk about the design points, but in more of a quote unquote American way, like, you know, the sandwich way of giving feedback. It's like good, mm-hmm. not so good, and good. So I kind of have to pay attention to the person's culture and then how I could work with them more effectively.
How does one, when doing this kind of research or reading about this kind of research, make sure that they're not picking a stereotype? Like, how can one make a generalization and say, yeah, that's generally true? For example, this says that, I'm just going to pick a country, that people in Spain are more confrontational and more emotionally expressive than people from the US. That doesn't feel like it's a bad thing. It's simply a statement of a generalized perspective. But if it goes too far, then it's a stereotype.
Of course. Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think that's something to be aware of. And even I sometimes make mistakes in making stereotypes instead of more understanding about culture. So my understanding of how to not make stereotype is to be aware of, for example, in the culture maps, like Spanish could be more emotionally expressive, but doesn't mean that they are emotional. Does that mean that they are, for example, linked to a more negative adjective? Then that is more towards stereotype. And for example, it's assuming that Spanish users will then do about this, then that could be a stereotype. But to use a more general statement that according to this data, according to Aramayer's chart and research, because Spanish users are emotionally expressive, so we should allow a way for Spanish users to express themselves instead of trying to not let them connect to each other. It doesn't make sense. Do you see there is a difference?
Right. It sounds like, you know, culture affects how you feel about something like an error message, about how you feel about an avatar, how you feel about the way a company talks to you. Like you gave an example of a project you work on that was for a Dutch company called Travelbird, where you changed the layout of a form because of the Dutch's kind of pragmatic nature.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was the example that I give for Netherlands versus Germany. Mm-hmm. So that's actually how being pragmatic and having high scores in long-term orientation can actually affect the interface.
Mm-hmm. And I assume that you can measure this, right? Like someone might be listening and feeling uncomfortable if they're American or Dutch or Spanish, but at the same time, you can A/B test these things, can't you?
Yeah. So a lot of these changes are actually based on research. So we're not saying that every single Dutch user loves discounts or every single German user needs details. Of course, sometimes a culture is very broad, and there's also cases where people like me, like, can I be categorized as Taiwanese? Can I be categorized as Canadian? Not exactly, because I have kind of multiple backgrounds. So there are cases where user does not identify with a culture, and that's okay. We're just saying that when we A/B test, when we have qualitative and quantitative data, the results that we see is that this kind of pattern works better for people in this country or people of this culture, but not necessarily everyone.
Okay. So again, when you're designing, you recognize that these are generalizations, but every culture is different and people cross multiple cultures. So you have to be prepared to A/B test and maybe be surprised.
Exactly.
Okay. So then if you are surprised with that, I assume that you need to, you know, measure and be prepared to change quickly and don't want to make assumptions.
Yeah, so that's kind of what I advocate in the talk, is that be prepared that the users may not react well to a UI UX pattern that they've been using for several years, and be prepared to A/B test it and also research what works better for their users.
A big thank you to our sponsors because they make this show possible, and I hope that you support them the way they support us. Progress Software is the creator of the most comprehensive developer toolkit for building modern apps on the market today, Telerik DevCraft. With more than 1,100 Telerik.NET and Kendo UI JavaScript components and controls, you can easily build modern, high-performance web, mobile, and desktop apps, as well as chatbots. The toolset also includes reporting solutions, automated testing and productivity tools, and comes with a range of support options. New this year is a free online training program for all license holders. With this, alongside thousands of demos and source code available, comprehensive documentation, and a full assortment of Visual Studio templates, you'll be up and running with the Progress Telerik and Kendo UI controls in no time. Download a free 30-day trial today at telerik.com/Hanselman. That's TELERIK.com/Hanselman. I mean, if someone's listening and saying, wow, you know, I do business in 5-6 countries, I'm not going to make a custom site just for the Germans. Is it more about looking at specific touch points within their UX and modifying just those?
So the difference of internationalization, so what you just described earlier, I18N versus localization, L10N, is that internationalization kind of takes account of all the differences within the demographics that they're going to target, like Germany and, you know, multiple countries in Europe, and coming out with a system that kind of is able to satisfy them all, and like, for example, having good name fields and whatnot. But localization is specifically making a custom design for that particular country in order to achieve the best effect. So whether to go with internationalization and localization is a business decision. Like Facebook, for example, and Dropbox, they are going after internationalization because they know they want to serve all of the users in this world, but they are not going to make custom designs for users around the world. But for other companies, they choose localization because they actually really want to target a few specific market, and they want to maximize return on investment in those markets.
Okay, so let me see if I understand that. So internationalization is, removing barriers to international deployment, making sure that the text is all local. But localization is more adapting the product to the local target market. It's more specific than just swapping out the text.
Yeah, so I cannot speak more about internationalization because I don't study in that area. But from what I understand, it's about knowing and studying, for example, all of the addresses in the world, and kind of coming up with a general address form that will suit every type of possible address. For example, it could have two address lines, and instead of zip code, it could use postal code / zip code / whatever term that they research and make sense for a lot of users across the world. To me, that is internationalization. But localization is like the address in Indonesia is like this. So when the user is coming from Indonesia, we use Indonesian address formats. But when a user is American, then we use American address formats.
Okay, that makes sense. So localization, like if we look at the W3.org, the W3C, they say that localization is that a real comprehensive thinking of the way that you do things being really focused on a given locale. So I like that. Yeah, you could just make a double text box and say, yeah, type your address. It's fine. We'll just put it in a free text box. But localizing is going to require a lot more work, but it might also make a happier user.
Yeah. To me, I feel like that's where I want to focus my effort, or I want to contribute to the happiness of the user filling out the form, because the forms have been localized.
Right. Well, and you point out something else that I found absolutely fascinating. I assumed that iconography and emojis were somehow becoming a standard. Like, for example, the hamburger menu. Like I figured... Mm-hmm. You know, I talk to my spouse and my children, they don't know it's called the hamburger menu. They know that if you click three lines, something happens. But did you point out that there's different icons in different countries? Like they don't use the hamburger menu as much in China. They use a different icon.
Exactly. So while the hamburger menu makes sense to us that working tech and does those that kind of live in a Western society. So in my talk, I point out that in China, what's more common is a discover icon with a compass image, where users learn to click on it or tap on it to discover more options. And that's more appropriate for the context of an Asian society, because people don't make the association where three lines equals hamburger. But of course, there might be users in Asia who are using a lot of Western apps, and then they actually know the three lines equal to more options or the menu. But still, in China specifically, they don't use that interface pattern.
Mm. And you also point out, kind of as a general generalization, that typing Chinese takes a long time. So finding the perfect word or precise word isn't as easy as browsing to the right location.
Yeah, so that's something where a design strategist at Mozilla has discovered, and that's actually his assumption. I'm quoting his assumption.
Right, Bram Pitoya.
Yeah, that was from his research into why do the Mozilla Firefox homepage look different for the US and the China. And China, where they use a more newspaper-style, dashboard-looking homepage portal design compared to the US, where it's very minimal, mm-hmm. very sleek. There's only one call to action. So his assumption was that perhaps because typing Chinese, we need to find a precise word, and there's literally like thousands of words for just one pronunciation. Mm-hmm. It could be easier if we just allow the user to choose and click whatever they see interesting instead of asking the user to type in what they're looking for. And I also feel like it might be related to the individualism cultural dimension, because this is my assumption. Perhaps the Western user want to determine, they want to choose for themselves what is it that they are searching, what is it that they are doing. But the Asian users, perhaps they are okay to be guided with options so that they can just click and browse instead of deciding for themselves what is it that they want to search. I'm not saying that Asian users don't search, but this is just kind of my educated guess.
Right, right. But it's also something that you can potentially back up with anecdotes and experience. Like, for example, your point that like Americans or Western society likes a lot of white space and a big text box, that kind of Google empty page or Bing empty page with a picture. While if you go to like Taobao, it's quite busy. It's almost like Yahoo 10 years ago with a lot of text and a lot of like, it seems like a fair statement that the Chinese seem to appear to like a lot more text, a lot more information on the page as a design style.
Yeah, exactly. And when I point out the two differences, and people are actually a bit shocked that how is it that a lot of the interface in Asian society looks so, to us, cluttered, busy, overwhelming. That's somebody's opinion, mostly from the Western society. But to the Asian user, they're actually comfortable with it. Because some people could think, well, if today I see a blank page, how do I know where to start? Like, how do I know what to type? Like, I'd rather just let you give me the options, and I can just know what are the top five news I must read today, what are the top five people I must follow, so on and so forth.
That's really interesting, because it's funny that we all think of the internet as being this global thing and everything should be the same everywhere. But I'm sure that you shop at a Dutch furniture store and I would shop at an American furniture store, and we eat at different places. The aesthetic of a Scandinavian furniture or interior designer is going to be fundamentally different from an American, from a Japanese or a Chinese. Why would they all want the same design on a website?
Yeah, exactly. That's a really good point.
Yeah, I'm realizing, though, that it would also be very challenging for Facebook to have an entirely different design. But at the same time, now I'm realizing I'm quite surprised that a Chinese, you know, if Facebook was in China, it should be quite a bit busier if it was going to cater to their audience, if it was going to be localized versus what you pointed out is that it's really just internationalized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So it sounds like we should research those local UI patterns and apply those. And you've put together a whole ton of information on your different Medium posts, and we'll make sure that we link all of this in the show notes. You also point out that when you're doing this research, that creating a persona to describe who that local user that has value to like invent kind of a person and talk about what they expect?
Well, technically, a persona, it is when somebody is inventing a persona, it's a proto persona, but in a ideal UX process, the persona should actually be researched and validated, because we could imagine what a South African user would do and feel and what's their goals and frustrations and needs. But without actually validating these, this is just kind of imaginary persona that's probably going to steer us more towards designing for stereotypes. So while personas is a valuable tool in a UX process, like I will advocate for validating and actually talking to these users to make sure that one's assumption and guesses are correct.
Okay, so make an assumption, but do it with research, back it up with research and thought, as opposed to being lazy and coming up with just a stereotype and then assuming that that's how a Dutch person or a Spanish person behaves online.
That's right.
Interesting. And you're almost like creating a characteristics card, like a Dungeons and Dragons, where it's like this person values easy and fast and cheap, and this person values this and the other thing.
Yeah, it's funny now that you mention it. In some personas, I do use those kind of matrix. Mm-hmm. Do they value speed? Do they value like ease? Do they value like whatnot? Mm-hmm. And now that you mention it, I think it's interesting if we could put cultural dimensions on it. For example, like, do they value long-term decision? Do they value like family? Do they value the collectivist society's input? That could actually affect the personas a lot.
Yeah. And you also point out the importance of using diversity and inclusion in even your creating of these persona faces. You know, it's really easy to go and search for a generic face and end up with, quote unquote, the default.
Yeah. So something that I encourage everyone to do, encourage all the designers, is to look up multiple cultural faces and like diverse users. If today one is designing international product, then make sure that the avatars are not just people of that demographic and not people of the same gender. Because I see actually a lot. I mean, it's a simple idea. It's a simple thing to do. But when I go on Dribbble or when I check someone else's portfolio, I see all the avatars are just people of the same race, people that look like they know each other. So it's something that people who design international product have to be aware. When we put diverse avatars, diverse faces in our product, it's more easier to imagine these users are using our product. So therefore, we kind of are a little bit more aware of their needs compared to if we just use avatars of the same races, same nationalities.
Yeah. And I think that those things seem kind of obvious, you know, to a certain kind of person. But at the same time, if you don't see your face represented, you can feel excluded. Something I noticed today, actually, my 13-year-old just got his first phone. And he's just begun to learn how to use the phone and text his friends. And I asked him in text, how do you like the phone? And he texted me an emoji, thumbs up. And it was brown. Because my children are black, and I said, "Oh, your thumbs up is a brown finger." I said, "How did you figure that out?" And he says, "Oh, well, it's my finger, right?" Mm-hmm. So he didn't want it to be just a peach colored finger or a yellow finger like the Simpsons, mm-hmm. and he did that entirely on his own, and I thought that was cool. So he's quietly and on his own, without even thinking about it, without, you know, he's a little kid. He's not thinking about diversity and inclusion. He just wanted the thumbs up to look like his thumb. Which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's. Thank you for sharing. That's really interesting. Like how to them is the default. It's not just like an extra option. But when we think about other product, like there are so many that don't kind of cater to international audiences, and we are experiencing frustration where they don't see their default. They don't see their finger color in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, you know, someone who is maybe not. Doesn't appreciate inclusivity or diversity, and they say, "Ah, don't worry about it. It's just a finger, right? It's just a bit, pick the one that looks like the Simpsons." may not realize that without any coaching, both my wife and my sons have just picked the one that looked like them, which I thought was interesting because I never taught them that, which kind of made me happy because now he's going to grow up in a world where, you know, he can pick the avatar. Or the video game character that looks like him.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. Well, you've put together a whole series of links to all sorts of research, and I'm going to include links to your Medium posts in the show notes. And I appreciate that in all of your writing, you include a lot of links out. It sounds like people have a lot of research that they need to do to learn about this stuff.
Yeah, I think the research, there's really a lot to do because I mean, I just designed for users of over 25 countries, but there are actually like something like 169 countries in the world. And I think I'm not even doing enough. I'm not designing a lot of users in certain regions, and because I'm mostly approached by clients from certain countries, like you can imagine. So definitely there's a lot for us to do, a lot to learn. But then the resources in my talks and in my Medium posts are, it's a start. It's a start.
And I understand that you also do do mentorship, but of course, as you are a an independent right now, you do charge a little bit for your mentoring services.
Yeah, I do. So I've been mentoring kind of part-time for more than a year now, and it's been really great to see how my mentees have grown to learn to improve their portfolio, get more confident in the job search, and even moving abroad to do what I have done before. And yeah, it's been really great to be a mentor, actually.
So that's great. You're not just mentoring on product design and UX, but also on how to potentially be a digital nomad. And it appears also that your mentorship is quite formal. You can set, you know, 4 or 6 month plan. There's homework that's tailored to their growth. It really inspires me to maybe make my mentorship experiences more formal.
I guess it's up to the mentor, because each person have a different teaching style. It used to be less formal than that, but then later I realized, like after a year, I was looking at their goals and then have I contributed to their successes? And I realized that for me, like my teaching style, it would help if I would actually talk to them about their goals and formulate a plan for them, instead of they are the one to be proactive to ask me questions that they think about. Because the risk is that they don't know what they don't know. And if they don't know what they don't know, then I should be, the mentor should be the one to actually teach them, the mentees, what they actually should know. So that's kind of why I personally have this more formal structure to approach this mentorship.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Of course. It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
So you can check out Jenny Shen at JennySHen.com and make sure to scroll down to the bottom and subscribe to her design newsletter. You'll get a newsletter twice a month and you can learn all about what she's doing and where she's going. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.